Beautiful song Ed just led. We normally sing the other music, same title at least, and some very similar words, but that's a beautiful song. You can sing that more often. Good to see everyone who's back this evening. I hope you've enjoyed the day. It's been a beautiful day to enjoy the holiday, but glad you're here. And as we turn back to the book of Job, in fact, I'd like for you to be turning, if you will, to Job chapter 2, and we'll get right back to where we were last week as we were looking at the story of Job. And tonight, we'll go further. In fact, to begin with, and if you got an outline, if you wanted to do that, you may notice from your outline, we're going to start just by taking an overview of the book. And indeed, that's what we're doing. We're taking, in general, an overview of the book. But tonight, we're going to look at it and consider it as a whole to start with. And then we'll begin to really focus in on this exchange of speeches, as it's sometimes called, etc., between Job and his friends. But if you're looking at Job chapter 2, when last we left him, and let's just go back and kind of situate this so I can look at it better. Let's go back and just kind of consider what we were looking at last week and sort of summarize it. When we left Job, we left him in really a pitiful state in chapter 2, in which Job has suffered great losses. In fact, the loss of everything, as we would look at it. And if we were to summarize that, I think we could boil it down to maybe these categories or whatever. Job has lost his wealth, to be sure. In chapter 1, we see all of those attacks, etc., and the loss of all the animals and all of that. The worst of all, I'm sure most of us would agree, if not all of us, but the worst of all is the loss of his children. Where the calamity comes, they're all gathered, remember, in the oldest brother's house. The calamity comes, the house falls in, and all the children are killed. He's lost his wealth, he's lost his children, he loses his health. At the second stage, as I'm looking at it, I said, if you remember, there are about three stages of his trials here. Stage 1 is when he loses all of those things, and then stage 2, he loses his personal health. Satan comes back and makes that challenge to God, remember? But he loses his health, and Satan strikes him with, we don't know exactly what. The Bible just simply calls it boils, or infections, or blains, or whatever. It's a very generic term. But from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. He also loses his position in the community. Be it a town, a village, the great general extended area of the land of Uz, or whatever it might be. But he's lost his position, and if you remember some of the terminology here, and sometimes it's overlooked, but commentators will often point out, if you look at the terminology, especially when it says he went and sat in the ashes, that the term that's used really is for like the garbage heap, where they would burn garbage outside the camp in Jerusalem. Over the centuries, literally, if you remember, they burned it in the valley of Hinnom, and a perpetual fire, just burned there, and that became Gehenna, and the picture that Jesus, and the term that Jesus and the apostles used for hell, if you remember that. Well, there was always that kind of garbage heap outside the camp, just a place of ashes. He just went and sat down in it. Whether he's that despondent, or he's that mournful, it's a combination of all of that. That's where he is. He certainly is not that revered patriarchal figure that we see him being in chapter 1. Remember, he's also lost the comfort of his wife, where she comes to the point he's blessing God, even through all the losses in chapter 1. When he's stricken with his personal health, etc., in chapter 2, she says, you know, why do you retain your integrity? Curse God and die. She is certainly not comforting him, but you know, let's not be too hard on her. Remember, she's lost everything as well. But he has lost that. We don't see for the remainder of the book any companionship whatsoever from his wife. And I think that's at least an interesting point to the book. He's lost the respect of his friends. That's evident. We may not have seen it so much. All we really have seen them do up to the point of chapter 2 was they just come to visit him. And they just kind of sit there with him. And remember, they sat silently for about 7 days, not saying anything. But we will come to find out very quickly as we get into these speeches that they've lost respect for him. They had it. And when Eliphaz will open his speech, the very first speech that we see from one of them, he'll make it clear that you really were a great man. But notice, just like that, you were a great man. They don't consider him so any longer. So he certainly has lost the respect of his friends. I think, and we'll see this tonight and even in the reading that Bill just did, he's lost his will to live. When I say he's lost his will to live, I think we have to be careful about the way we approach this. I don't want to downplay it, because I think you lose the sense of the book if you do. But I don't want to charge Job falsely either, so I'm going to be very careful as I go through this, and I'll explore it in just a moment. But I believe he's lost his will to live, and I'll show you why I say that. We haven't seen it yet, but we will come to see that he's lost his self-assurance. He will make reference later in the book. We won't look at it tonight. We will see it later. But he'll make reference back to the fact that he once was a very self-assured individual. He knew who he was. He knew of his place before God. He was certain of it. He was assured of it. And all of this has come. He doesn't understand it. So he's lost all of that. He's questioning. He's filled with questions. He's humbled by the questions. And maybe we would even say he's abased by them. But to the point that he has no self-assurance. Now, when I say that, at first time I said, well, now, wait a minute. Because all through the book, we see him arguing with the friends, and he seems to have a great amount of self-assurance. Let's make a difference, and we will see that as we come, especially as we dig into the book deeper and deeper. We will see a complex view of Job, where, yes, he will argue with his friends on the one hand, but as he pleads, really, just out to the great wide open, but I think more than anything to God. He's addressing them, but he's really pleading to God without understanding. Basically just saying, I don't understand it. So he's lost a great amount of self-assurance. When you look at all of that, and you think of an individual that in a few minutes' time, in a great respect, maybe a year's time in totality. Remember how we were counting that last year. But you think of someone who goes from having everything. I mean, even the confidence of God to place him in this position. Have you considered my servant Job? When you think of someone who goes from that to where he is as we see him at the end of chapter 2. Notice verse 13 again where we ended. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and nobody spoke a word. Job doesn't speak. They don't speak. They saw that his grief was very great. When you see that, when you see someone go from, basically that high, as we would sometimes say, to that low, or up there so far to down there so far, it's an incredible thing. We perhaps in your life, and maybe not, but perhaps in your life, you've witnessed the breakdown of an individual. Maybe a number of things happened to that person. Maybe they came in quick succession. And you watched an individual just basically fall apart. And if you've ever witnessed that, it's a very sad thing. And it's the kind of thing that you can't help but sympathize to a degree. You can't help but be filled with grief about it. You're also filled, I think, many times with questions. Certainly about it. And maybe you're ready with a quick answer, and I think we see that on the part of the friends, and oftentimes there's not a quick answer. And I think Job teaches us, and it teaches us many great lessons, but one of the lessons it teaches us is not to be too quick in judgment, not to be too quick to maybe step in and say, I've got the solution, Job. I've got the solution. I know the answer, because many times we don't. Now, that brings me then to the series of speeches. And if you're looking at your outline, I'm not going to get deep into any of this, but if you're just kind of looking, I want us, first of all, to scan the book and just think in terms of the book. You'll notice, and many people divide the book of Job similarly, and I suppose everybody has their own little twist, exactly where to divide it up into different sections or groups you'll see sometimes. It doesn't really matter. It helps you by breaking it down like this to kind of see the book. And if you just notice, and this is where I choose to break it down, but many people very similarly, as I said. But if you'll notice what happens in the book, you start obviously with this great lament of Job, and we'll get into that in a moment. But this great lament of Job, where he finally speaks, he breaks the silence. Remember, he's not said anything for quite a while, and even when the three get there, nobody says anything for a week. And now he finally breaks the silence, and when he breaks it, I mean, it's just like Bill read, it's heart-wrenching to hear what comes out of his mouth. Very quickly, if you'll notice, Eliphaz answers it, and you'll see that on your outline under 1b. But Eliphaz answers it, and then Job replies. And that kind of sets the tone for what's going to happen for 30-odd chapters here, or maybe 40. But if you'll notice, Job will speak, and then one of them will answer. I divided it like this into section 1, where each of them takes a turn at basically answering Job. Job laments, Eliphaz comes in, Job replies to it, Bildad comes in, Job replies to it, Zophar comes in. And that's pretty much what you have. And I liken it to, because it's not just a speech, it's certainly not a comfort. I mean, when you read their speeches, none of them are sort of putting their arms around Job and saying, man, I feel your pain and I hate what's happened to you. You just don't see any of that. What you see more than anything is a charge. They get very quickly into debating Job, and so I've come to call it over the years a cross-examination, where they speak, it's like two lawyers. I mean, Job is in the position of counsel of the defense, and the different individuals are like the prosecution. And they're offering their prosecution of Job. And so each one will speak, and Job will reply. Now, when you get into the second round, that it's just like the first. Each of the three takes a turn. You know, Job answers, and it's kind of like coming back with your second rebuttal or whatever. But each of them takes a turn. When you get to section 3, you see a lot of, and really this section of the book, you'll notice you're down to chapter 20 by the time you get to this. I'm not going to look at any of that tonight, but if you go home and read the book, and by the time you reach the middle of it, you see a tremendous amount of frustration set in on the part of everybody. And it's kind of like that. I mean, if you picture the idea of people involved in very serious discussion, everybody's had their turn, everybody's tried to answer what the other person's saying and all of that, and it just kind of reaches a point where you know you're at a stalemate on a lot of points. And it really reaches that. I mean, when Job replies to Zophar's second answer, he gives his reply, he kind of sums up, if you read it, he kind of sums up what he said, and Eliphaz quickly jumps back on that, and Job answers it again, and he's really getting intense at that point. Bildad comes back, but if you look down at point number 3, you'll notice something that really changes here. When Bildad comes back with his third speech, quote-unquote, it's very short. It only lasts for about 6 verses. And I like to say it like this when I'm overviewing the book like I'm doing right now. Zophar doesn't even bother. In other words, it's very interesting. You've had each of them give 2 speeches. Eliphaz tries a third time. Bildad a very abbreviated try. And Zophar just doesn't bother. And then you kind of reach that point, and Job again comes out, and he's intense. Notice under 3E, if you're looking at the outline, or if you're just kind of keeping up with this, after that short answer by Bildad, Job launches into a 2-chapter speech. And it's very intense. And it's at that point then, and if you will notice also, he doesn't stop there. Really what he does, if you look at section 4, or looking at your outline, and I called it this, you can call it anything you want to, but Job's closing remarks to those three goes on for several chapters, as a matter of fact. In fact, all together here, we're looking at a section of the book where Job speaks from chapter 26 all the way through chapter 31. And it's the longest speech Job makes in the book by far. And it's really a defense. I mean, if you look at it, this is where Job... Well, as when we get into it, this is what I will say about it, but I'll go on and say it right now. This is where Job crosses the line. And we will see that. He goes too far. And I'm not going to go deeper into that, but certainly when we get to it, I'll show you why I say that. And it's at that point that it elicits a fourth person that up to this point in the book, you didn't even know was there. And that's a much younger by the book's description, a much younger Elihu. And if you remember what I said a couple of weeks ago about Elihu, a lot of times I'm convinced that the wisest one of the bunch sitting there was the young guy. And I don't think it could be for a number of different reasons. But Elihu really launches into Job. And for that matter, he launches into a long speech about the whole situation. If you're looking at your outline or you're kind of flipping through your Bible, you may notice that Elihu's answer, whatever you want to call it, goes from chapter 32 through chapter 37. He only has one. I mean, we don't see him going round after round with Job, but the one is is really something when you look at it. Now, following Elihu's answer, maybe some have said the only thing that cut him off or shut him up, I don't know if that's true or not, but following his answer or his speech, notice under section 5, or if you're looking at your Bible, chapter 38, this is when God speaks. God has been silent in the book. It's interesting, because if you go back, the last thing God said was to Satan. And what God said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Basically, he still retains his integrity, even though you caused me to move against him. And Satan said, "Yeah, but skin for skin, remember that. The man will, everything he gives, you know, everything that a man has, if I can get it out, will a man give for his life. Put forth your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse you to your face." And the last thing the Lord says is, "Behold, he's in your hand, but save his life." And God goes silent. He's been in the hand of Satan for all this time. Now, we don't know how long this lasts. I mean, we read it. It's a number of chapters. Time-wise, we're not given an indication of days passing or months passing or hours passing. We don't know. At least hours, but we just don't know. But he's been in the hand of Satan and God has been silent. But now, and I believe due to two things, maybe three things. Due to the inability of the friends to get off their false premise. Maybe they just never leave it. Secondly, due to the fact, and mostly due to the fact, that Job has some flaws. He had some, and I think that's what caused all of this. And he crossed the line, and God addresses it. And lastly, due to what Eliphaz says, and there are some elements of Elihu says, and there are some elements of what Elihu said that are addressed very specifically. But when God speaks, you'll notice that God begins totally to rebuke Job. Now that's interesting. Because God was last seen speaking, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And basically what God seems to be saying in the opening part of the book is, he's perfect. And regardless of what you do to him, he'll be faithful to me. And Satan's charge is, no, he's not. And he only does it because you buy him off. And finally and ultimately, Satan gets to the point of saying, "Let me afflict him personally, take away his health," is the idea, "and you'll lose him." Well, God doesn't lose him ever at any point in the book. But the next thing we see God do is rebuking Job. Not, as many might suppose, commending Job. In other words, you might think after all of this, when it finally gets to the end, and we're coming to the end of the whole ordeal, you might think God would speak from heaven and what you'd hear out of God's mouth is a real commendation of Job. You know, sort of one of these, "Ain't he done great? I mean, look at what we put him through, and hasn't he done fantastically?" But you don't hear that. In fact, God launches into a 3 or 4 chapter, rather, rebuke. Goes from chapter 38 through chapter 41. And Job weakly, meekly answers it briefly for about 3 verses in chapter 42, chapter 40. We see Job replying to it. And then the Lord comes back and rebukes him some more. So what we see is that there are some problems. And that there's far more to this book than maybe, you know, if you're not familiar with it or really have dug into it, you just kind of get this idea that Job has gone through a great trial here, and he passes, you know. And I think that's the way it generally is presented. He's a great man, and he passes the test, and he's blessed by God in the end. And when I was a kid going to, you know, various Sunday schools and Bible schools and that kind of thing, that's pretty much what I would hear. But when you really dig into the book, you see that, no, life is not that simple, and neither is this situation for Job. We'll look at God's rebuke of Job, and it's, I mean, being that it's coming directly from the mouth of God, you wouldn't expect anything less, but it's really, you know, an awesome speech that's made, and we will certainly see that. It humbles Job, and at the end of the book, and if you're looking at the outline, Job will do nothing but confess. And that's, in a sense, very amazing. You start in chapter 1 and you think of the first thing that's said in the book. Go back to chapter 1 and verse 1 again. The very first thing that is said is there was a man, his name was Job. And the man was perfect and upright and one that feared God and eschewed evil. Remember, we were talking this morning in the lesson, and we were talking about the idea of, you know, the measuring stick that God has and how God looks at us. We talked about the rich young ruler. And said, you know, by most people's standards, that would be an exemplary person. Well, by anybody's standards, Job is an exemplary person. But he's not without need to improve. And neither is anybody. And so it's interesting that you start off in the book with a description like that about Job, and you don't see that about many people in the Bible. But the last chapter, the last thing you see from Job is a confession. It's also interesting to me that God rebukes the three friends. They've done a lousy job. And you dig into it and you see it. I mean, their job of comforting Job stinks. It really does. And is a great lesson to be learned from how these three really blow it. And God rebukes them. And it's also interesting to me, and I think quite fitting, you just don't see the same kind of humility and confession out of them. They may have done it, but it's just not addressed. Finally and ultimately, of course, as everyone knows, Job is blessed by God. And we will look at that. There's some interesting twist, so to speak, even to that. And the book will leave you hanging with a lot of questions. So in many respects, it is an interesting book. Now, that's a real overview of the book, in keeping with the whole tone of the way we're approaching this study. But I'd like to go back, and I'd like for you to, if you will, in the last part of this lesson, I'd like to take a look at the way the speech is, so to speak, begin. I'd like to look at chapter 3, look at what happens with Job as he opens with this speech, this lament, as it's sometimes called. One of the saddest scenes in the Bible. Many people look at this as the saddest. In other words, what you hear out of this great man, it's pitiful. I mean, he has all of this in chapter 1, and by the time you get to chapter 3, the first thing that he says, I mean, you see the condition he's in. What I tried to describe last Sunday night, I wasn't trying to underestimate it. The condition he's in, he opened his mouth, the Bible says, and cursed his day. And when he begins to speak, it really is pitiful. There are several things that he says. Wait on that for a moment, because I decided I want to look at that and then come back to it. But there are several things that he says. Let me address one of them here, and then I'll move ahead to looking at all of them together. There are several things that are difficult for people to understand. Sometimes people look at this, and I was reading this one commentary in preparation for this week's lesson. And what this guy, his take on it was this. He said, remember that the book is inspired, but what Job says, basically what he was saying is what Job says is not. And what he meant by that was it's an inspired recording of what Job said, but that Job is not speaking as a prophet here. And his bottom line conclusion was what Job says is just wrong. I mean, it's wrong for a person to be like this. And he offered his reasons why. You might agree with that. I don't. When I look at this, I don't see Job at this point in chapter 3 as doing anything but what is natural. Now, I will admit to anybody, if you read through these first 10 verses, that what Job says, I mean, when he says things like, let the day perish wherein I was born, and so forth and so on, that certainly he begins by wishing that he had never been born. I want to suggest to you, though, that that's different from wishing you were dead. Sometimes a person will be filled with enough despair, sometimes even a Christian will, and they'll say, and they mean it, I wish I were dead. I just wish I was dead. And someone will very quickly caution them and perhaps even get a little righteous about it and will say to them, you know, life is precious and life is a gift. And make a turn to passages in the Bible and show just that. Life is a gift from God, and we're put here on the earth to serve God, and we should be like Paul, to live as Christ, and as long as I'm here on this earth, I'm going to serve Christ, and on and on and on. And none of that is wrong. But to say that a person never gets to the point that circumstances, and I'll say it like this, that circumstances in life never drive somebody to the point, not of wishing they were dead so much, in that sense that most people mean by it, but wishing they'd never been born. That's nothing more or nothing different really than saying, this is so bad, it's too much, it's more than I can take and want to continue to live. I think that's fair. It's not that Job is ready to commit suicide. Sometimes when you read commentaries about this, Job is at the point of suicide. I disagree with that. If Job were going to commit suicide, surely he would have done it. I mean, when he sits down in the ashes and he scrapes himself with the potsherd here, it's not that he's trying to kill himself. But is he filled with absolute wonder at what's happened to him? Sure he is. And wouldn't any of us be at that point? No, he's saying, I wish I'd never been born. He's saying that it's just too hard. Now, it's not, but I think that's the way he feels. And I liken it very much to an ordeal in Paul's life. Not going to take a great amount of time, but it gets you to go home and read this. I want to mention a situation, a time in Paul's life. You might turn to the New Testament and look at this. Like I said, I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on it, but you can go home and look at it for yourself. Remember that Paul, on what we call the third missionary journey, went to Ephesus. And by all admission, when Paul went to Ephesus, he had his greatest success of any city and any missionary journey. In other words, when he gets there, people begin to be converted. So much so that Paul opens up sort of a school, is what it appears to be. And it talks about all these people from Asia coming in and studying with Paul and all of this kind of thing. You can see it in the opening verses of Acts chapter 19. And so much so that the description there is that Paul decides he will stay in Ephesus for a while. In fact, if you take a look at Paul's missionary journeys that began roughly AD 41 or so, and lasts for the next 25 years, he never remains anywhere as long as he does in Ephesus, except by force, when he's in jail at the end of Acts. In other words, he moves very quickly from place to place, but when he gets to Ephesus, he stays, because he's having great success. Now, what happens there, let me mention this as well, because I don't want to miss this point. He has left a place where he had some trouble, Corinth, but he had success. Many Corinthians, hearing, believed the gospel and were baptized, Acts 18, verse 8. So back to back, Paul has gone into two of the most prominent cities in the Roman Empire, Corinth and Ephesus, two great port cities. And two huge churches have been started. A lot of success has happened very quickly back to back. And this is all in roughly the mid-50s, AD-50s. Now, what begins so great in Acts 19, and for that matter, in Corinth, when Paul planted, and Apollos watered, and Cephas was even there, Peter was even there, and so forth, all of it ended badly. So that by the time when Paul is writing 1 Corinthians 16, Corinth has already gone bad. And when I say bad, I don't mean that it's the end of the church in Corinth or anything, but you know yourself when you read 1 Corinthians, it's just filled with problems. He's having all this great success in Ephesus, but at the same time, right at the end of it, he's having to deal with all this mess going on in Corinth. He's intending, if you read 1 Corinthians 16, he's intending to wrap up this great success in Ephesus and move on throughout Macedonia and Achaia, those churches there, Thessalonica, we would know them, Philippi, Corinth, and all of that. Some of them he needs to straighten up problems. Some of them, like Philippi, are going fantastically. But he's intending to wrap up his success in Ephesus, leave some of the younger guys there, and move on. But that falls apart. And when you look at Acts chapter 19, not only is he having to deal with Corinth, but he's also having to deal with the fact that almost overnight, or maybe over afternoon, this Demetrius causes a mess in the city. And I mean, it's a horrible mess. And Paul basically, rather than getting to just pack up and move on in a wonderful, good way and everything be wonderful when he does leave, he has to quickly get out of town yet again. Now, all of that begins to work on Paul. And we see it when we come to 2 Corinthians. And when you read the opening verses of 2 Corinthians, I'd like for you to do that. When we see Paul open up 2 Corinthians and start down in verse 3, we see Paul at arguably the lowest point of his life. He's praying. And he says, "Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies, the God of all comfort." Now, I'll caution you to understand something as he's writing this. The time I'm speaking of, the lowest point, has already happened. It happened after he left Ephesus like he did, and before he writes 2 Corinthians. Now, you have to understand, in the context of the book of 2 Corinthians, added to all that mess is the fact that when he wrote 1 Corinthians to try to straighten out the mess, they reacted badly to him. In other words, all that stuff we were saying this morning. And, his epistles are weighty and so forth, but he just a little runt of a man, and he doesn't look all that good, and he doesn't sound all that good. He's weak, all of that. He went through a really rough time over all that. And he talks about it here. And he speaks of God, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation, all our trouble, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. He says, "For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. And whether we be afflicted, it is for your consolation and salvation, which is effectual in the enduring of the same sufferings which we suffer. Or whether we be comforted, it's for your consolation and salvation. And our hope of you is steadfast, knowing that as you are partakers of the suffering, so shall you be also of the consolation." Now listen to verse 8. "For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed," and I want you to hear this phrase, "we were pressed out of measure." What Paul is saying there is, it was too much. Or if it was not too much, it was so much that it pressed us to the point, notice the phrase, above strength. Beyond our strength. In so much that we despaired even of life. That's where Job is. You want a biblical description of where Job is? That's where he is. It's where Paul went at one point in his life. Sometimes things happen in life. We don't know all the reasons why they happen, but they happen. And they happen so much that you get to the point that you wish you'd never been born. You wish you'd never lived. Or like Job goes on to say here, "If it's not that I wish I'd never been born, I wish I'd died when I was." Because a Christian can look at it, and a person might say, "How can you think in terms of you wish you were never born? If you were never born, you'd never have a soul and you'd never go to heaven." Fine then. Fine. "I wish I had been born." and I wish I died when I was. Because if I was, if I died when I was born, I'd have a soul, and I'd go to heaven, and I'd have all the blessings and the wonders of heaven and of being with God for all eternity, but I wouldn't have to go through this. And I can't take this. It's just too much. A person might say, you know it's not and you know it can't be, and quote to us 1 Corinthians 10. Well, fine then. But it feels like it is. And if an apostle, and you can't read past those words, we were pressed out of measure, above strength. If he can feel that way, so can I. And that's the point. When you reach the wall, when you reach the point, I mean, there's a level that we all can take. There's as much as we all can take. And the closer you approach it, for those of you that are, you know, calculus people and so forth, when you get to the limit, it feels like it's more than you can take. And that's where Job is. I wish I'd died when I was born. When we look at Job, his great lament is, I wish I'd never been born. Or, I wish I'd died at birth. And finally, he says this, if not that, then okay, I've lived, and I've done what I've done, and it's been good. And as I look at life and its prospects, I have nothing. I have nothing. I don't have any of the wealth I built. I don't have the marriage that I built. I don't have the children that were born to me and that I raised. I have no health. I have nothing. Then let me die. You reach a point in life, and I believe we see this sometimes. Sometimes we see this in old people. There are no prospects for a future. There is no reason, rationale in their mind to keep living. And you will see sometimes a very old, very tired, very worn out, very weak, faithful Christian look to a young family that's pleading, hold on, hold on, I need you, I need you. You will see them look at that person and say, let me go. Let me go. And I think that's what you see ultimately out of Job. He longs for the relief that death will bring. If you look carefully at the end of this chapter, look at chapter 3 and verse 20 beginning. He will say, wherefore is light given to him that is in misery? Why is light given? Why is light given unto the bitter in soul? Why does God do that? Why does God continue to let someone live, notice verse 21, who longs for death? That's where Job is. He longs for death. I'd like for you to compare that, if you will. Turn over to chapter 6, when he will come back in this next answer. Look at verse 11, when he will say this. Yeah, that's the right verse. What is my strength that I should hope? What is my end that I should prolong my life? He sees no prospects for a future. Now, as I close this, and of course I'm going to come back, but as I close this, I don't want to leave you with the false impression that Job is right here. He's not. No more so than if you know an individual that is so overcome with grief that he can't see any prospects for the future. He can't believe that life could possibly, there could be any reason whatsoever for him to live. He may very well be wrong. Job is wrong. When you look at this book, that's one of the things that God will tell him. I have a life plan for you. In fact, he hasn't lived half his life yet. I have a life plan for you. I've got a future. I've got another life for you to live, Job. But put yourself in these shoes. Try to imagine, and I say try to imagine, being where he is, right here. It's all he can feel. It's all he can see. And ask yourself the question, is it not at least fair that he say, I see no reason to keep living. And that's the way he feels. I think people without God give up at that point. People with God, they fight. They fight to believe and fight to understand.
and godly people hold on to God. We'll close with that and we'll pick up next week with what Eliphaz will come back to say and what will begin to happen here in this cross-examination.